Welcome to Southern View Sound and Music's third podcast of Studio V with your host, Paul Vastola. So far, we've been all about the grand piano and artists who have made their careers with it. Today, we'll feature certified expert Reed Schaefer on the care and feeding of this animal and go inside the instrument itself. Reed has been Paul's go-to tech and tuner for decades, and the two often become immersed in deep conversations about pianos. Reed was kind enough to share some of his extensive knowledge of pianos with Studio V. So, relax and prepare to learn more than you ever expected about this grand instrument.
My podcast series has been about the piano, and I've presented wonderful pianists who have great relationships with the instrument, but they were primarily players and composers. Our discussions kept bending toward the music they made instead of the instrument itself. So in this episode, we'll have more piano and less music. For me, it started out as a 7-year-old who couldn't wait to turn 8, because we could play piano at 8. Couldn't play before 8. It was like a rule of some sort. We had a monstrous upright that I sort of learned to play. I would regale my mom, my aunts and uncles with the predictable repertoire that the young people played. And as long as all the notes worked, I was hardly aware of what the piano was doing. If it was in tune, didn't really pay attention to that. It sounded okay. We got it tuned once a year, once every couple of years. So let's fast forward to today, where I now am the most critical, obnoxious observer of every piano that I come across. I'll be sharing this episode with my longtime piano tech and tuner, Reed Schaefer, with whom I regularly engage in lengthy conversations about everything piano. So Reed, how did you get started being a piano technician?
My mother actually got me started because I had dropped out of college and I had a rock and roll band, and she didn't consider that a job or anything with any kind of a future. So ironically enough, she took the Denver Post because my parents owned property out here in Hiwan. She got the Post and she saw this article about this little tuner guy with his little shop, and she thought that that'd be right up my alley because I was a tinkerer. I took my clarinet apart and put it back together. I took the piano apart and put it back together. And I was fascinated by the machinery and the workings of the piano. So this was some years before when they bought me a piano so I could take lessons. And I was more interested in fooling with the piano than I was in playing it.
That is so cool.
So fast forward a few years later, I'm 19. And so she found this little guy in Hickory Hills, Mr. Nartnick. And he was going to charge me to work for him. And I would come once a week for 4 hours and work in his shop on various little projects, key bushing, and there's a myriad, many repairs and allied arts to being a piano technician.
Now, what town was this in? Where was this?
This was outside of Chicago, but he lived in a town called Hickory Hills. And then some years later, I was in a band, and our organ player was taking tuning lessons. And I said, really? And I said, from who? And he said, this guy named Bill Farrell. He said, he's really a cool guy. Here's his number. So I called him up, and I took my first tuning lesson at Universal Studios in Chicago. And Bill was this monstrous genius, which I didn't know at the time, mathematical genius. And he spread out this giant chart of logarithms on how to scale the Steinway B. And I was dumbstruck and totally flustered and said, well, man, do I have to know this to become a piano tuner? I was just hoping you'd show me a little something about the temperament, you know? And he folded his stuff up and he kind of was irritated. He said, well, I'll make you a better tuner. He said, we'll get to that later. I did eventually have a few tuning lessons, and you go back and it's so difficult. It's one of those things where if you knew how hard it was to do this, you would never have started in the first place. But I was stubborn, and the challenge was there, and I eventually got the hang of it, and you progress through trial and error, and I got a job apprenticing in a shop in Evanston, and that's when I really started to learn, was from the older guys.
Was that shop, you did more technical stuff rather than musical?
Yeah, it was a full, yeah, it was in a guy's basement, but it was a big basement, and we did restringing and everything but refinishing. We didn't do finishing. But Lenny Pirani, great piano player, was the action guy, and Bob Erickson was the stringer. He taught me how to string, and Farrell was associated, ironically enough, he was associated with Ken Sweet, this Ken Sweet Associates. He had 12,000 piano accounts on the North Shore of Chicago. He employed 6 tuners full-time. And this was a different era, obviously.
You mean when there was many more pianos to service?
Many more pianos to service. Every theater, every venue in Chicago had multiple pianos. We would go down to the Hilton and tune 30 pianos in a day. I had recording studios. There were many, many recording studios. I had 6 in my personal stable.
And did someone allocate this work to you, or did you just drum it up?
It comes along, and Ken would refer stuff to me. Here, take that one. He said, I don't want to mess with them. Just take it. It was the kind of thing where you were thrown into the fire. If you had any talent at all, you were thrown to the fire early because people needed you. You know, go down to the Erie Crown Theater, man. They need a tuner right now, broken string.
You have a great story about getting thrown into the fire, don't you? Like when your first studio tuning gigs?
My first studio job was in 1975. I worked on a record for Ramsey Lewis. I was paid to tune the Steinway B in Studio A, which was at one time the largest recording studio in the country. I was paid $25 an hour to stand by, sit in the booth and be on standby, which I thought was just the be all and end all. So this is the big time. I'm here, you know.
So Ramsey Lewis was a pianist.
Yes.
And so he would have been pretty particular.
Absolutely. Yeah, fortunately, these pianos were tuned once a week by people much more proficient than me at that point. So all you had to do was strip it out and learn from their tuning and clean up the unisons. But the art of setting a temperament and tuning a piano takes many, many, many years before you get any good at it at all. And the funny thing is a lot of people, as you mentioned in the beginning, they don't know. They play a fixed tone instrument. And they don't develop a sense of pitch or harmony like a person that has to blend with other voices or other instruments, saxophone, clarinet, whatever. Your brain automatically finds that pitch. If you have musical talent, you'll find that correct pitch.
By bending a reed or whatever?
Well, by bending your voice or whatever, mm-hmm. Learning to sing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the singing is the most primitive and first musical instrument that anybody had. Right. My first musical experience, I had a good voice. They put me in the boys' choir. I was doing the Gregorian chant in the Catholic Church when I was 9 years old before my voice changed.
Now, wasn't that satisfying?
It was beautiful. It's still one of the best musical experiences of my life.
Everybody should participate in choir if you can sing at all.
Absolutely.
So I recognize you as an expert on the piano, and I credit you greatly with teaching me much of what I know about how the piano works and what goes into making a piano sounding great. When it comes to piano maintenance, you and I have seen the good and the bad, but there seems to be kind of an intense feeling among peers, your peers, about the quality of service from techs because there's a lot of art and tons of subjectivity that go into the skill that's required. So what, in your opinion, makes a great piano tech tuner?
My teacher, Bill Farrell, said that a great tuner has to be a person that likes good sounds. You have to be someone that is willing to work hard to make something sound as good as it can sound. The fact is piano tuning is actually, it's not as subjective or art-oriented as you might think. Every good tuner comes to the same place.
You told me about all those tuning variations that guy put down on, he showed you these sheets and stuff. Those are different temperaments and different ways to approach tuning?
Those are historical temperaments. Now, the equal temperament is also a historical temperament, which people forget. But equal became pretty much the standard and the norm when the piano became kind of the king of the world, because the equal temperament works best on the piano. Now, you can use, and people are using, alternative temperaments, mean tone temperaments, and temperaments that actually sound better. They have more pure intervals than the equal temperament.
Tell me what equal temperament is in a short sentence.
When Pythagoras devised the original diatonic scale, which is Western music, that's the do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, he derived that from a single monochord using the harmonics of that monochord. The first time we pluck a string, it divides itself in half, and then in half again, and then in half again, and then in half again. So you have this series of harmonics that are built on a single fundamental chords, say that pitch is 110. Well, then when you put your finger on a guitar at that node, which is halfway, you'll hit that harmonic. It'll go boom, bing.
Right.
So that's the octave. Mm-hmm. So the frequency for that note would be 220. 110 would be the fundamental. The first time it divides itself in half, it's two segments of 220. And then again, 440. So by using this harmonic structure, the first harmonic is the octave. The second one is the fifth. And that's where the magic comes in, is with the fifth. The circle of fifths, the cycle of fifths, all of that is what all of modern music is based on. So what Pythagoras discovered was that by taking that fifth, that harmonic, he could build the do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do.
The 12th tone.
Out of that single monochord. The thirds are the ugliest interval in the equal temperament. They're not even remotely close to being pure.
Yeah.
So there's a dissonance that's built into this thing that is up to the concert technician to remove that dissonance as much as is possible. I can tell you in two words what a great concert tuning is: perfect twelfths. And that is the octave fifth has got to be pure. And you do that by cheating. You widen your octaves as you go. This is called a stretch tuning, really incorrectly called a stretch. But you actually have to widen the octaves in order to achieve that brilliant, sparkly, beautiful tone for a piano.
So now we're introducing kind of art and magic against mathematics.
There's definitely an art to it, and it is. The things that happen are magical, but there's mathematical reasons for all of it. The ratios that sound best to us, the intervals that sound best to us, are the ones with the purest ratios, 1-to-1, the octave, bump, that sound, oh, isn't that beautiful, you know? And then you hear the fifth, and it's oh, this lovely, nice, sonorous. Those are the ratios that are the closest. Now, the further you get out, the minor seventh, major seventh, so those are the more dissonant intervals, and those ratios are not as pleasing.
I don't want to get too far into the technical weeds because it's scary to think about how many variables there are.
It's real similar to chess. There's only a very few moves. You have a certain number of players, but the possibilities become extremely complicated.
That is fascinating analogy.
That's what happens with these temperaments. Uh-huh. Bach's well-tempered clavier is not an equal temperament. It's well-tempered. He didn't use it. Nobody back then used equal temperament. Because if you put it on a harpsichord, the harpsichord sounds awful. I didn't learn that until after I'd been tuning harpsichords for 5 or 6 years. Why do my harpsichords always sound awful? It's because you can't use equal. And that's all that I knew. So until I started using the Marpurg, the Velotti, all of these many, many temperaments, which purify many of the intervals, one-fifth will be horrible. It'll be unusable. Sometimes maybe even 2 or 3 fifths. And what they do is they just write around it. They don't use them.
They don't use those notes.
They don't use them.
So how is an octave on the harpsichord? What happens with
that?
Well,
you have to have pure octaves. Otherwise, you don't have a system.
Yikes.
It's a deep subject, and you can really get lost in some of the technicalities of it.
I totally get that. It's almost frighteningly deep.
Well, it's so deep that a lot of professional musicians do it with talent and with their ear. But if you asked them to break down exactly the difference between playing in a Marpurg orchestra and an equal, they wouldn't be able to tell you.
Maybe not their job.
It's not.
All right. Well, let's talk about you and I. We met at the first studio where I had actually gotten a job in Denver. When I came here, I was digging for work as a recording engineer. Had no experience, really, except hobbyist. But I got a job at a place called Communic Creations in Denver. A voiceover studio, but it was, you know, had some musical ability. They had a Baldwin 5/8 Baby Grand at that time. It was not a bad piano. This was very early in my recording career, and we had graduated from a little Baldwin Acrosonic that was a kind of a rehearsal piano that was in the building. What do you think of the Acrosonic?
Well, tuners have a thing called acrophobia, which is fear of acrosonics. You know, any small piano, spinets should never ever be manufactured. It just doesn't work. There's a reason why they make pianos 9 feet long and longer. The Germans built an upright that's 15 feet tall, that's supposedly the most harmonically perfect piano in the world. And the reason is because in order to make a perfect harmonic structure, you should actually double the length per octave. Now, if you start out with 2 inches as your top C, C88 is, generally speaking, 2 inches of speaking length, which yields about 160 pounds of tension at the frequency that it's tuned at. So if you double that 2 inches, by the time you get down to the bottom of the piano, you're over 12 feet or 15 feet. You wouldn't think so, but if you do the math, it works out to a lot of inches by the time you get 7 1/3 octaves down there.
So there isn't kind of an optimal size of a grand piano, which is even larger than the concert grands we have today.
That's correct.
Wow. Although Community was a voice and commercial production studio, my boss knew I was getting more into the music recording, and he bought that baby grand at a liquidation sale. And up until then, I was trying to squeeze an actual piano sound out of the Baldwin. I would take off the front face. I took off where the legs were and tried to get mics in there so I could get more of the sound of the streams.
Even you couldn't make that thing sound like anything.
Well, it was a good learning situation for me, though, you know.
It is a decent, for what it is, the Acrosonic is probably the best of the small pianos ever made. It was a very durable piano. It's what I had. That's what I, my first piano.
That's its reputation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, getting that baby grand really kind of upped my game, though. It was 5'8", but hey, now we have a grand-esque piano, but I wanted that Elton John sound. I wanted that big, aggressive piano sound, and I didn't exactly know that much about how they got that, but this is the kind of sound that I was looking for. Interesting thing about this recording is the piano starts out on one side of the stereo, and then a little later in the song, it's joined by another piano part that's on the opposite side of the stereo. It's pretty interesting. As the song goes on, you'll recognize this brassy attack sound of the hammers on the strings. Check that out.
Like a corn in your mint, I am dented and I'll spit with hot treason. Through a glass eye, your throne is the one danger zone. Take me to the pilot for control.
You'll notice when the piano comes in solo again, it's on the left side only. So what we have is two monaural recordings of this big piano. Interesting. I met an older gentleman who was our piano servicer at the time. His name was Ed DeTurk. When we first got that 5/8, I wanted more of that aggressive sound. So he came in and I convinced him to dope the hammers.
Lacquer the hammers.
Yeah, yeah. And he was a seasoned tech, and I learned a lot about altering the sound of the piano from him. But talk to me a little bit about doping.
It can be a very effective tool. It's been used on Steinway pianos for years and years. And when I was a young tech working at Hendrix and Downers Grove, who was a Steinway dealer, one of the great, actually two of the old-time guys from Steinway came out and gave a seminar for technicians. There was 150 guys in this room, you know, to hear from the great Joe Vischelli, who was the voicing master. And one of the techs at the end of the session, they raised the Q&A, and the guy raised his hand, and he said, when did Steinway start using lacquer on their hammers? And Vischelli says, the day we ran out of shellac. So, in other words, pretty much forever. Steinway made their own hammers. Now, a lot of hammers are bought. Abel is a great hammer, German piano. There's a lot of action makers, just like in the car industry, someone will build carburetors, Holley or something like that. So in the piano industry, there are key makers. Cluj make great keys, keyboards. They specialize in, and then the piano manufacturers buy these parts and put them together to fit their instruments. But Steinway always made their own stuff because it was unique in that it has a brass rail and there is no other action that's like it. The flanges are different. The way it's put together is different. Some of it's really great. Some of it isn't so great. But the Steinway hammer was a very soft hammer, so it gave kind of a mellow, soft sound. And big-time players don't want that mellow, soft sound. They want people to be able to hear them inside Orchestra Hall and to hear them over the orchestra. So they started making the hammers harder and harder and harder to impart a more powerful blow to the string, which of course increases the amount of volume.
Sure.
Also makes it a harsher type of volume. The harder the string, the more high harmonics you're going to hear in that string, which can lead to zinging and pinging and all kinds of noises that you don't want. But those guys don't care about that. Now, if you're in a recording studio, that zinging and pinging is a big problem. When you're on stage, no one can hear it because everybody's the first guy is 100 feet away from you.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a totally different thing.
So Steinway figured out a way to satisfy these people who wanted to cut through.
Well, somebody there in the piano shop and somebody said, these hammers are, I can't get anything out of them. You know, they're just too soft. And, well, they'll play in. In 10 years, you'll shape them down and they'll sound beautiful. Well, people don't have 10 years anymore. We don't want to wait for anything. So Steinway, and along with, now there are other ways to make a hammer hard without infusing it with dope. The reason Steinway had to use lacquer to actually harden the wool into something that's not really wool anymore. It's wool and lacquer. But Abel is a hammer that doesn't use any kind of juice. They have perfected this art of making a hammer, which is actually a pretty difficult thing to do. It takes some interesting equipment and a lot of pressure. And it's an interesting process. And people have been trying to come up with the perfect hammer for a long time, the perfect combination of...
And you and I are just talking about the compacted felt piece that strikes the string.
That's
this
the hammer.
This little microcosm.
Yes.
And it just shows what an amazing instrument this is and how complicated the whole system is.
Well, there's over 12,000 parts in a grand piano,
jeez,
which is twice as many as an automobile. Now, many of them are the same part over and over again. Obviously, when you look at an action, a single whippin, one whippin, which is the mechanism that throws the shank and the hammer towards the string, is called the whippin. There's probably 25 or 30 separate little parts, spoons and pieces of felt and pins and jacks. And so this is an extremely complicated machine, and you're trying to make a precision machine out of wood and leather and steel. It's not very easy to do.
Well, talking about that Steinway, I have a little story about when I first came to Denver searching for my recording studio gig. I get out the Yellow Pages, which existed back in the 70s, and I started looking for the recording studios. I found one interesting little studio in Glendale in the back of the police department. I don't know what it was doing there. And after I had knocked on every door of every other studio and been extremely disappointed by the, some of them were in the back of somebody's house and this lady who was this weird wig and she was running the Pacific Records and it was pretty crazy. The people at this studio were nice enough and they just let me self-tour the studio. It had a glorious, huge piano in one kind of sound-dampened room. So I sat down at that 9-footer and I was blown away. I couldn't play much. I can noodle, you know. But that piano began to stir something up in me. And so from that day forward, I never gave up the quest for that awesome sound. And that was a Steinway D that I had accidentally encountered. So that taught me that the size of the piano was a big factor. That unmistakable Steinway sound of the Concert Grand is evident in so much music that we hear. When you hear the intro to this song, you can actually envision those beautifully hardened Steinway hammers striking those strings. It's a beautiful sound.
Put on my blue suede shoes and I boarded the plane. Touchdown in the land of the Delta Blues, in the middle of the pouring rain. WC handy, won't you look down over me? Yeah, I got a first class ticket, but I'm as blue as a boy can be. Then I'm walking in Memphis, just walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam. Walking in Memphis, but do I really feel the way I feel? Saw the ghost of Elvis on Union Avenue. Followed him up to the gates of Graceland.
and I watched him walk right through. Now security, they did not see him, they just hovered round his tomb. But there's a pretty little thing waiting for the king down in the jungle room. When I was walking in Memphis, I was walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam. Walking in Memphis, but do I really feel the way I feel? They've got catfish on the table, they've got gospel in the air. Reverend Green, be glad to see you when you haven't got a prayer. But boy, you got a prayer in Memphis. Piano every Friday at the Hollywood, and they brought me down to see her, and they asked me if I would do a little number, and I sang with all my might. She said, tell me, are you a Christian child? And I said, ma'am, I am. Tonight, walking in Memphis, walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam, walking in Memphis. But do I really feel the way I feel? Walking in Memphis. I was walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam, walking in Memphis. But do I really feel the way I feel? On my blue suede shoes, and I boarded the plane. Touched down in the land of the Delta Blues, in the middle of the pouring rain. Touched down in the land of the Delta Blues, in the middle of the pouring rain.
No, I had to play that whole song. It's, to me, a classic, and it's built on that great piano sound. Many of Bruce Hornsby's hits. Those pianos, I believe them to be Steinways from those classic Chicago or New York studios.
They are Steinways. He's a Steinway artist.
And they must have that incredible hardened hammer, because those pianos just scream.
There's a unique sound that a Steinway has, and although I think there are other pianos that have surpassed it, Steinway was absolute state-of-the-art instrument during most of the 20th century. They invented the modern piano.
Well, I think their reputation has dieseled on to where it's just, you just recognize it's like saying Cadillac, and you say Steinway, and everybody believes that that's a great instrument.
It's one of the most recognized brands in the world of anything. Whenever anybody talks to me and I tell them what I do for a living, do you have a Steinway? That's the only thing that they know about pianos, is the word Steinway.
And here's another one of my favorite pieces of music by one of my favorite players, Bruce Hornsby. Another super great example of that incredibly piercing Steinway sound. I paid my dues there for a number of years, and eventually in 1989, I got the opportunity to open my own studios, Rocky Mountain Recorders. We were building real studios, music studios, anything you can do in a studio, we wanted our studios to be capable of. So piano was real important. I borrowed a 7-foot kwai from somebody, and he needed somewhere to keep it. So we stored it at our studio. That was the first big piano that we had, but I could never get bonded with that kwai. I don't know what it was. I don't know what the model was or anything. But my partner had a family heirloom. It was a 1928 Steinway B, which you rebuilt.
Yeah, we put a soundboard in that, a pin block in it. Rebuilding, including the soundboard, should really be left to the factory.
This brings up another thing that you and I have chatted about, and that's old pianos versus new pianos. And a lot of people love that old. I don't know why 1928 keeps coming up. People seem to prize these early century Steinways, and you and I had chatted about that, and I have a newer piano, and you've said you would much prefer to have a newer piano under your care than an old one that needs all kind of stuff.
The age of a piano is only important insofar as how well it works. First and foremost, the piano is a machine, so it's more like a car. Now, if you have a vintage car that's really tricked out and beautiful, that's wonderful. Pianos don't age well, generally speaking. There's a tremendous amount of tension on that thing. There's 16 tons of tension on a big Steinway. So if you put that into one cable, you'd be able to lift a city bus off the ground. So that's where all that energy and power comes from, is that stored tension, that tremendous tension. Each and every string pulls anywhere from 160 to 300 pounds of tension, every single one of them.
And how many strings did you say?
230 some odd strings.
Yeah.
And now you're stretching this over a very thin piece of wood that has to be very delicately, beautifully made, has to be crowned and ribbed. And that soundboard, the poor thing, is under 1,500 pounds of downward tension. Because when that string crosses over the bridge, it has a slight downward, what's called downbearing. It has to push down on the bridge ever so slightly. Otherwise, the sound won't be transmitted to your amplifier, which is the soundboard. So if the down bearing is incorrect, if the workmanship is shoddy at the factory, they have too much bearing, soundboard can literally explode. You'll have crack and crack and crack. Kawai had many cracks in their boards when they first started bringing their pianos over here. Yamaha, the same thing.
My friend Lisa had a Yamaha C6-footer. She'd be in the kitchen and she'd hear this bang.
Pow. And that was the soundboard opening up.
What do you mean opening up? You mean literally breaking?
What happens is this, is that soundboard is arched upwards, what's called crowned, just like a violin top is. In order to withstand that downward tension, you've got to flex it upwards. So that soundboard takes up a certain amount of space, square inches, inside the case of that piano. As the soundboard shrinks, the case of the piano does not shrink. So now the mass inside there becomes less, and a crack opens up to take up that space. The cause of cracking in the soundboard is humidity changes. If something was always 80% humidity, that'd be okay. The piano would take it. If it was always 20% humidity, like low humidity in Colorado is perfect for the piano. Keep it out of the sun, though. The sun is the enemy. But
I try and run my humidity here 30, low 30s.
30 is, that's about perfect.
When we finally got rid of that kwai at Rocky Mountain Recorders, you helped me locate Joe Woods.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a used C7. It was pretty new. It was, I think, an 86. And we're talking about 1991 or so here. So that thing was only a few years old. But apparently some teacher had purchased it, and then I think she wanted a Steinway. And she traded the Yamaha back in. And so Joe brought us that piano and cut us a really good deal on it. That turned out to be a really good purchase. And I remember he came in with an iron. And he was heating the hammers with that iron because, again, I wanted more of that aggressive sound. So what was he doing?
He was compacting the fibers of the wool. The hammers that we mentioned are made out of highly compacted wool. What he was doing was heating the fibers to make them contract, and he was hardening the actual strike point of the hammer. It's an old school method. It's not really very effective, to be honest with you. You got to sit there for a long time with your ironing tool, and then, you know, you'll be lucky if you don't scorch one of the hammers, and now you got a brown hammer in there, so it's not something I really took to.
Interestingly, that piano has become one of the more revered studio pianos in town here. So there had to be something good about it. Pretty soon you took over maintenance of it.
The great thing about C7s is they're extremely consistent. It's a mainstay of recording studios across America. It's a good workhorse piano. It's not a Steinway D, but in the hands of a talented recording engineer, you can get pretty much everything you need out of a C7 that you're going to get out of a piano.
That C7 became my benchmark of an instrument, and when it was time for me to own a piano, I began to compare all the pianos that I shopped for at Beethoven's and Steinway Hall and wherever against that piano. And ultimately, in my trip to New York, I ended up in New Jersey at a mall and went to the music store there. They had a C7, a Yamaha C7. I sat down and played it, and I said, I am home. I've now been convinced, even the nice Schimmel that I played at Beethoven's pianos and all those Bostons and Steinways, I felt like really at home with this piano. So that encouraged me to focus on that piano, and Joe found me the one that's sitting here right next to us. You know, after all the talk we've had about my piano and my quest for the ideal piano, we ought to listen to what my piano sounds like.
Thank you.
Well, that's one of the most successful designs in the history of pianos, and it's a true semi-concert in the fact that it's big enough to be deemed a true semi-concert. The Steinway B is not even 7 feet long. So
it's
that is
6'11",
not it's not a great scale, but the scale, because of the extra length, the 20 bass, now it's 23, I think, on your piano. But back then, it was 20 wound strings in the bass for concert and semi-concert pianos. Still the norm.
This Yamaha that I have, a 1999 or 2000, has a slightly different scale of the bass strings.
Yeah, and the scale refers to the size of the wire that is used in designing the scale. You must obviously weigh the wire down in order to slow it down. We talked about the 21-foot piano. In order to make that wire have more mass on a shorter piano, you've got to add weight to it in order to slow it down to the frequency that you need at the proper tension.
Are you talking about the string itself?
The string itself.
So that's why you're talking more winding more stuff around the
core. The copper adds mass and it adds weight. So by graduating the size, now the size of the wire at the very top of the piano is only 31/1000ths of an inch. And you have four unisons of that, and then you go to 32/1000ths, and then you go to 33. And by the time you get down to the bottom, a number 20 is 45/1000ths. And the tensile strength of a number 20 wire is well over 1,000 pounds.
Is that the largest unwound string?
The largest unwound string is a 20 on your piano, but it could be more. They make unwound wire all the way up to, I believe, a 23. And when you watch Jaws, that's what Quint is using to catch that shark with his piano wire. It's the strongest steel made.
You know, I think about when in Beethoven's and those guys' days, Chopin's days, these guys were monster musicians, but they were playing on instruments that were cobbled out of primitive materials.
By today's standards, they were extremely primitive. And actually, those guys, Beethoven even, I don't see how they could have executed what they were writing on the crap that they had to play on. Now, and a lot of these guys were instrumental in helping improve the piano. Erard in England was a big innovator in the actions and trying to work with artists and find out what do you need this thing to do that it's not doing. So it's interesting because the piano, as we know it, is really less than 200 years old, a modern piano. It didn't really wasn't invented until they learned how to cast iron. Until they learned how to make a plate called the cast iron plate. And the plate is put together on top of this extremely strong superstructure made of wood. And they're bolted together to withstand this tremendous amount of tension without buckling or bending or even moving. Because if it moves, your piano's out of tune.
In the early 1800s, what was the harp made from?
Steel.
They bolted it
together.
Wow. No one ever tried to make a harp out of wood, oak, or anything like that.
I mean, if you consider the piano being invented in 1609, which I don't, Cristofori was a harpsichord builder, and he put a set of hammers under a harpsichord and called it the piano forte, a harpsichord with loud and soft, because, of course, piano is soft in Italian, which is an ironic name for the loudest instrument that there is, which is the grand piano. So it became shortened to just piano, but he called it a piano forte, however you pronounce it, a harpsichord with loud and soft, because he could make different sounds by how hard you hit the key.
But the harpsichord is one shot.
The harpsichord is plucked. So once you depress that key, it doesn't matter if you depress it real hard or real soft, you get pretty much the same sound. And that was what instantly intrigued him with this, is by hitting it harder or softer, you actually get a different kind of a tone quality.
So he kind of transitioned from the harpsichord theory towards the actual piano theory with the hammer and action.
He pioneered that idea. And so the thing probably sounded more like a hammer dulcimer than anything else. It didn't sound like a modern piano, I guarantee you that.
Well, getting back to my own quest for a piano, I became obsessed with the shopping process. I follow a website called Piano World, and they had featured a book by a woman named Perry Nyes, who was searching for her perfect piano. And she wrote an interesting book called Grand Obsession that chronicled her own personal search for her ideal piano. And she ended up with a Grotrian Steinweg. And that's
Steinway in German, by the way. Grotrian and Steinway built their first pianos in Germany. And then Henry Steinway emigrated to the United States, I think, in 1853, and he went to work for Mason Hamlin in Boston. And he actually learned his piano building chops from Mason Hamlin. The full fit pin block, all of that stuff was Mason Hamlin originally. They're very similar pianos, and Mason Hamlin was a very respected piano at that time. And in the 1919s, 1920s, so the Mason Hamlin was every bit the piano, and they were a big battleship.
You have any thoughts for someone who's a prospective piano buyer? You know, let's say it's a person who has a certain amount of skill and they want a decent piano.
The Japanese pianos are a good choice for somebody on a budget. Kawai is a good alternative. Yamaha used to be a tremendous bargain. It's not really a bargain anymore, but it's worth what you have to pay for it, unlike some other instruments. Now, you can spend a lot of money. You can buy German pianos. Blüthner is a phenomenal piano, very expensive piano. There's a piano called a Sauter, S-A-U-T-E-R, which is a German piano, fabulous piano, hand-built. Fazioli, of course, is now, people consider that the state-of-the-art, the benchmark, and they are absolutely fabulous.
My reaction to this Fazioli is I got to play one at a NAMM show, and it really was magical.
They're as good as it gets. And one thing I'd say about the piano, if you're looking for a piano, 90% of instruments manufactured worldwide are junk. The decisions about what kind of piano you're going to make are made by marketing people and not by musicians and piano people. If you want a really good piano, an acoustic piano, your choices are pretty limited, to be honest with you.
Well, certainly the German ones, Valentina Letizia, one of my favorite pianists. I believe she's Russian.
She destroyed a Hamburg Steinway on stage in Vail. She blew up multiple strings. Yeah, the Russians do it to prove how tough they are, and it's a macho thing. Even the women do it. They always like to blow up a string or two, just so you know that they're really into it.
I believe she's a Bösendorfer artist. I have some videos of her playing. And the Bösi is a pretty good piano, too.
Overrated and overpriced.
Love it. All right, let me let you finish up here. How do you see the grand piano in today's world, maybe relative to 50 to 100 years ago?
The work in my business, I've been doing this for a half a century, and all the work now for me as a piano technician is at the top end of the spectrum. People like you who have a recording studio, I have talented amateurs that have big pianos. I have professional musicians with big pianos. I have numerous festivals that require concert-level work because these are the top people in the industry, and they accept nothing less than a perfectly tuned and prepared piano. The challenge to do that kind of work is always been my favorite part of the industry. The choices, as I say, are pretty limited for great pianos, and the people that play them are always going to be there because it's too wonderful of a thing to ever die. But it's a much diminished role in our society, and it's becoming kind of anachronistic in a way because people, they're not lining up for classical music. They're not lining up for most of the demographic in these places where I work are pretty old people, and there aren't young people to take their place.
You made a really good point there because, you know, when you go to see a classical concert, there's very few people with not gray hair. Yet I feel like this great piano music will remain timeless.
How could Chopin ever go away, Rachmaninoff, Tchaikovsky? This stuff is the greatest music ever written, and that era will never, ever, ever come again. That was magical stuff.
Well, man, this has been so great. Thank you so much for doing
my
this
pleasure
for me. I hope this is as interesting to my listeners as it is to me, because it's one of my favorite topics of conversation.
We hope you've enjoyed this Studio V podcast as much as we did making it. For a top-notch piano technician, you can contact Reed Schaefer at wrsjust@hotmail.com. Learn more about Southern View Sound and Music and our beautiful Yamaha C7 Conservatory Grand at southernviewsound.com. We'd like to thank Mark Spiroff and Conifer Radio for this opportunity to share our stories. Thanks for listening.